connecting more with nature during these stressful times. Have you found yourself spending more time watching the wildlife in your backyard or neighborhood since the pandemic hit? The birds on the bird feeders, the fox that crosses the yard at dusk, the proliferation of chipmunks in the stone wall? If so, you are not alone. With many of us either out of work or working from home, there is renewed awareness of the natural world. And it makes you wonder, is there more wildlife around because of the pandemic, or does it just seem that way? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will learn about changes in nature from ecologists and wildlife educators, and we'll get tips on safely getting out and exploring the natural world that surrounds us all. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Because of the pandemic, many of us are spending more time at home and paying more attention to the natural world around us. Today, we'll talk with some people who are involved with the study of Maine's wonderful outdoors to learn what they are observing. Sarah Rogers is with us. She's the school program coordinator with Cattance River Education Alliance. Nat Wheelwright is ecology professor emeritus at Bowdoin College and author of The Naturalist Notebook. And Bob Cordes is special projects coordinator of the Wildlife Division of the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. As always, we want to hear from you. Are you seeing more birds and other wildlife about you? Have you been exploring new trails? We invite you to share your stories and your observations. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Nat, welcome back to Maine Calling. I know that you spend a lot of time outdoors. Have you noticed anything different this year?
Well, Jennifer, thanks for having us on the show. Boy, I've had a heck of a lot more time on my hands to look for things. So, yes, I've seen a lot more. Whether that is due to kind of cleaner air and less traffic, or just simply the fact that we're all slowing down and paying attention to things around us, I couldn't say for sure. Kind of suspect the latter. You know, we just have a few speed bumps in our lives, and we've taken all the noisemakers away, and we're just appreciating what's around us.
So right now, what are you looking for? What's going on?
Oh, boy. Right now, I'm actually looking out the window at home. Monarch butterflies just appeared a couple of days ago. I kind of keep a little record of things that happen. Mosquitoes are fierce, but that's kind of fun to tie it to that big rainfall that we had in late June. And, watching the parade of insects and flowers, and birds are quieting down towards the end of the breeding season, but there's still a lot of bird song. So for your listeners, if they want to start to become familiar with bird song, it's a good time to listen, because there really isn't an overwhelming chorus of birds. So lots to look at and listen to and smell.
All right. Sarah, what are you attuned to right now?
Yeah, well, it's funny. We actually were just outside eating lunch, and we had our very first monarch of the year appear, like Nat said. So I guess Harpswell and Brunswick are pretty closely aligned. We're having some close-up interactions with wood ducks in our garden. And another thing, my kids and I have been spending a lot more time outside without school this spring, and it was amazing how much we noticed just wandering around. It wasn't a planned activity. We just went for a little walk. We saw one day a turtle coming out to lay eggs near the edge of the lawn. And one time we heard all this racket up in a tree, and we looked up, and some woodpeckers had actually nested in a tree cavity, a little hole in the tree. And we were able to see the parent arrive right in, obviously bring food to the babies and fly off again. So that was a kind of really special moment for us at home.
All right. Bob, one of the big questions right now is there more wildlife, or does it just seem that way? And one measure is that there's been less wildlife killed on Maine roads this year.
So I think still, we do monitor wildlife, and and do a variety of surveys throughout the spring and summertime, and so those results are not in yet. But I would echo what the other two panelists said, and you know, just people being at home, being more restricted, and having more free time to enjoy the outdoors. I think people are just noticing animals more. So whether there's an uptick in trend or not, but not sure yet. To be determined, I guess. And then the roadkill, you know, there's a lot of factors that go into that, but certainly being less people driving on the roads, less people commuting, definitely can have an impact on critters. You know, there's a lot of frogs and toads and salamanders that are killed on the roads that go unnoticed. And you know, we notice some of the big ones when we hit them, but there's a lot of little critters that are impacted that may not be so this year. And so those numbers are down, that's good.
Yeah, I read a 44% decrease in roadkill in the springtime, which, you know, seems at least to me like a pretty big number. Nat, I want to ask you about what you're hoping that this time that's otherwise pretty rotten will mean for wildlife ecology, wildlife education.
Oh, boy. Well, that's, gosh, I mean, I think anytime people become just a little more grounded and appreciative of what's around them, they begin to see things, they know things, and I think it's almost inevitable they're going to fall in love with the environment and nature, and that's going to make them more effective stewards of our natural heritage. So I guess I'm always hopeful for that. I think I've been saying that for decades. And we do see progress, but maybe like so many things that are changing in the world just these last months, maybe this really is the time that people will appreciate cleaner air and vibrant, healthy landscapes, and will dedicate the resources and cast the votes to make the world a more sustainable place in terms of our environment, our special environment, particularly here in Maine.
Sarah, I know that what you specialize is helping educators use nature, use ecology to teach. Why don't you give those parents who are spending lots and lots of time with their kids right now some tips on getting outdoors and talking about the nature around us right now?
Yeah, so that's a great question. It's something that I've been getting a lot. The typical question that people ask is, what's an activity I can do when I go outside with my kids? What should I do? And I really like to flip that on its head, because it's not about having a structured activity. Kids have plenty of structure already. So the outdoors is a great place to actually have unplanned time. The number one goal you should have is to get out the door with your kid and dedicate the next 30 to 45 minutes to exploring and being open to what happens. So what I like to say is that nature is what determines what the activity is going to be that day. Obviously, if you head out the door, sometimes we all know as parents, you do need a little bit of a plan to jumpstart you. So some little tips and tricks that I like to tell parents when they're outdoors is, look for balance beams, and that's downed logs where you can kind of balance along the logs. We do a lot of stump jumps, so looking for little stumps along the trail where you can hop up and jump off. I've been doing that with my kids since they could walk, and now they're much more dramatically doing it on their own. But ways to, like, keep engaged with what's around you and make it a fun experience. We also do something when I'm at CREA and we're teaching with kids, and we have a group. Something that's really fun is called stalking walking, where you try to sneak up as quietly as you possibly can to the other people in the group who have their eyes closed and see if they can hear you coming. So just things like that, ways to keep kids who otherwise might become unengaged, to help them just get in the mood, get in the vibe of being outside. And from there, what's great about nature is you never know if a weasel's going to cross in front of your path, if a toad's going to hop in front of you. You can't predict what's going to happen. And that's when the magic of being outside with kids really happens. So just let nature be the guide, I'd say.
And I want to ask you, when is it a good time to start turning over rocks and looking for salamanders?
Yeah, well, that's really an ongoing activity. So one thing I do like to say, and I want to say up front, is salamanders are wonderful here in Maine. There's tons of them. There's a study that showed there's more biomass of salamanders than any other animal. So if you made a pile of all the salamanders in Maine, all the redback salamanders, that pile would actually be bigger than the pile of all the moose in Maine. So there's a lot of salamanders out there to find. But you do want to be able to remember that you can safely put their log or their rock back over. So once you flipped over the rock, make sure you put it back so that they'll be safe. But you can really do that year-round. Redback salamanders, if parents are looking, are about the size of an earthworm. They just have four legs and a rust-colored red stripe down their back. And we, even at CREA, when I was out with students on a field trip, we have found eggs with those salamanders. They're one of the salamanders that lay eggs on land instead of in the pond, like we're often used to.
And when you say CREA, you mean CREA, Maine?
Yes, sorry, CREA, Cat Ant River Education Alliance.
Ah, okay, gotcha. Okay,
we
great.
That a lot.
Turning to you, Bob, this is a time when we're trying to be safe, not just safe from ticks, because of Lyme disease, not just safe from mosquitoes, but also from one another. What are your tips for folks who are using public lands in Maine right now?
We have a lot of land that has free access, not just public lands, but private lands as well. We're pretty, as a people here in Maine, we're pretty open to other people using our properties and private lands. So I think beyond the parking areas, it's pretty easy to social distance, keep that 6 feet apart. But, just be cautious at the parking areas and private property rights and those kind of things. But I think getting out there is the most important part. I think there's a lot of research that shows great health benefits from people connecting with nature. And as an American people, we have lost that touch with nature, so the more and more we can do it, I think, has positive mental and physical health benefits.
Sure, and we already have some messages to that effect. We have, Roger on Facebook who writes, being quarantined to my home for health reasons, I've spent hours on my back deck watching the birds, many varieties, red and gray squirrels and chipmunks. Each day they get closer and less skittish. Happy to spend time with them. They are just wonderful. And Karen writes, I urge more people to enjoy the natural world as I have for more than 60 years. I just coordinated an annual loon count on Maine lakes, and it's always gratifying to see how people enjoy it. Being aware of the natural world puts things in perspective and allows some comfort and serenity during rough times. Nat, did I hear you jump in over there?
Well, Karen's comment about the loon count, which I assume she's doing through Maine Audubon, is a wonderful example of a citizen science, or I guess we're now calling it community science project that anyone can get involved in. So you can count loons, you can count trout, survey that, you can get involved in the what's called the USA National Phenology Network. And what that means is it's a group of people all over North America who simply record when their lilac bushes flower, or their forsythia, or daisies. So there are feeder watch is another example of a super simple, really interesting community science project run through, I believe, the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, where you simply record what birds you see at your feeder. You aggregate all this data nationwide, continent-wide, and then we start to really see the patterns of nature and where things are increasing, different species are increasing or declining. So really encourage people to get involved with these sorts of science initiatives for all of us.
All right. Can I add one thing to that?
Yeah, both of you can go. First Sarah, sure. Then Bob. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to add, so for in particular Project Feeder Watch, that's something that my family did during quarantine this spring. And I will say that for kids, the idea of connecting with animals is really powerful. That's actually part of Richard Liu's most recent book that he was on about a couple months ago on this show. But having the kids become more connected with the animals they're seeing around them. We had that with the Project Feeder Watch because different birds come through here just on their migration and they keep going north. Some come just for the summer. Some are here just in the winter. And the kids really got to know, oh, he's gone. He came. He left. He's not here anymore. And it really got them thinking in a more close way about the animals that are around them. And developing that empathy is a big, big, one of the most powerful parts of kids spending time in nature, is the empathy they can develop with the animals around them.
If you'd like to join the conversation talking about noticing nature, learning more about nature while we are all spending more time at home, spending more time not indoors, put it that way, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. We have a Facebook post you can put a comment on, or you can tweet at Maine Calling. Joanne writes, having been teaching from home this spring, my girls and I saw and heard more birds than we ever have. Mating and competing blue jays, cardinals, goldfinches, and woodpeckers. It was just so fun to listen and watch. We've also had a bear and wildcat sightings in our neighborhood. Well, that's exciting, Joanne. I'd love to know where you live. Nat, I know that there's been some really discouraging news out about the worldwide bird population. Is there any chance that this year, this pause in the activity, human activity, will help that?
I think there is. I saw a term, now I'm going to forget what it's called. The era we're in, the geological era we're in, has been called the Anthropocene, which is a reference to humans' impact on everything. But I think I saw something called like the Anthropause or something.
Yeah,
that was called. So we're seeing, for example, greenhouse gases are declining in the atmosphere because we're not traveling so much and burning so much fossil fuel. So some really dramatic changes. The question is whether we can have the resolve to stick with it. And you know, to be honest, I don't feel terribly positive about it. And also, there's another kind of worrying aspect to the pandemic in terms of wildlife. Here in this industrialized, prosperous country, we're seeing animals show up in cities and they're crossing streets and everything's quiet and wonderful. But in the developed world, places like the Amazon and Madagascar and places that have the highest biodiversity in the world, because of the lack of social safety net, people are having to turn to wildlife for food. So it's actually having the opposite effect. So I would expect, back to your question about bird populations, they may have gotten a little bit of a breather in industrialized countries this year, but in other countries, probably people are shooting them to feed their family.
Mm. Bob?
I was just going to add, you know, the department, back to some of the community and citizen science, one way to help monitor some of these things is, you know, the department has some projects going on right now to keep track of birds, for instance, with the Bird Atlas, and always looking for volunteers, and people don't have to know much about birding to join in. They can just take note of the things that they know about in their certain area and document it for us. And we have other programs like Deer Spy, and so these all go back into the management of our species.
Wonderful.
Get a good accurate count from our community.
And can we find information about things like Deer Spy on the department's website?
Yep, mefishwildlife.com, and all those kind of things are there.
Wonderful. Well, we are going to take a quick break talking about nature during the pandemic. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Breakwater, offering summer day camp programs for ages 3 to 18 through August 21st, enrichment.breakwaterlearning.org. And TrueLine, a full-service marketing and branding agency who believes in the value of local independent journalism. Online at wearetrueline.com.
Join Eckhart Proy and the Portland Symphony Orchestra for a musical adventure featuring Scheherazade. Tune in to hear Rimsky-Korsakov's beloved classic, alongside Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet, and the premiere of Fumi's The Telling Rooms. Don't miss a moment of the magic this Symphony Sunday at 3 on Maine Public Classical.
Welcome to Maine Public's This Is My Maine. I grew up here most of my life, and I think the thing I love most is family. It always draws you back. Friends become family. And being able to walk outside each day, and it can be like a mini adventure. Not to sound too corny, but you know, you can go in the woods, you can go on the beach, you can go peruse the shops. It's really nice. It means being home. I've moved away a lot of times, and Maine definitely feels like home. My name is Kaylee, and this is Delia. We live in West Bath, and this is my Maine.
This is My Maine is brought to you through the support of Eaton Peabody, the Maine Community Foundation, and the generous support of members like you. Thank you. Go to mainepublic.org to experience more of Maine Public's celebration of Maine's first 200 years. Happy birthday, Maine.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, observing the natural world that surrounds us. Joining me, Bob Cordes with the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, Nat Wheelwright, author of The Naturalist Notebook, and Sarah Rogers with the Cadence River Education Alliance. We invite you to be part of the conversation. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. On the line with us now is Noah Perlett, a professor and chair of the Department of Environmental Studies at the University of New England. He's also an ornithologist with an expertise in ecology, conservation biology, animal behavior, and more. Noah, welcome back to Maine Calling.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Has the pandemic affected how you are observing the world around you?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, everything from just having the opportunity to spend more time outside, you know, both during the day and at night, you know, and also in some ways limiting our ability to study those animals in far off places, which has been sort of more of a challenge.
We all seem to be seeing a lot more squirrels and chipmunks around. I understand you and Nat had a little fun putting together a video about these creatures.
That's right. That was great.
tell us why. Why are there so many chipmunks?
Well, I don't have a great answer for that, in all honesty. I mean, other than the fact that small mammals like squirrels and chipmunks go through cycles where they have basically boom and bust years, usually every other year or sometimes every third year. I'm sure all the folks that were in Maine and southern New Hampshire listening a year ago remembers, you know, Squirrelageddon, where gray squirrels a year ago were just everywhere. And this year it's the chipmunk year. You know, and they've just taken advantage of some kind of resource that's allowed them to make a lot of babies really fast.
Anything else you'd like to share?
Well, you know, I've been asked, I've really enjoyed listening to the conversation so far, and I've been asked so many times this spring and summer about, you know, do I think that there's more birds here right now? And I certainly agree with other folks' thoughts that part of the reason people are saying that is because they're outside seeing it more. But I do have sort of a potential crazy hypothesis, and I'd love to hear from Matt, see how he thinks about this. And that is, every year in the U.S. alone, around 600 million birds die from building strikes, where they collide into buildings and die. And the peaks of those mortalities occur during both the spring and the fall migration. And this year, during the spring migration, so many of the buildings that birds would fly into were not lit up at night. And so potentially there actually were more birds that arrived to New England and to the breeding grounds because there were fewer collisions on their migratory route as they came north. You know, I do not have any data in any way to support this idea, but it's something I've been thinking about and curious about.
Thought, Nat? Thoughts,
yeah,
Nat?
Oh, I like it. As usual, Noah's got a wonderfully creative approach, and I think you could well be onto something. I certainly hope it's true. And, you know, you mentioned 600 million people, not million people, million birds are killed by building strikes. 10 times that many are killed by cats. So the question is, how has the pandemic affected whether people keep their cats indoors or not? Because that could also change things for the better.
Noah, thanks for calling in. That's Noel Noah Perlett, professor and chair of the Department of Environmental Studies at the University of New England. I'm going to go to Laura calling from Portland. Hi, Laura. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for having me on, and thanks for doing this show. I certainly enjoyed the birds, and I live in Portland, and there's a fox in our neighborhood, and have heard a lot of animal sightings from people. I'm actually calling just to talk about the issue of equity, that it's been recognized, the disparities in health supports across our communities during the pandemic, and where connecting with nature and animals is a healthy resource. And I'm hoping that there is more support for schools to use the outdoors, not just as a response to expanding spaces, but also because school is where we can really support equity for students having access to nature. So I would love to hear what some of the guests on the show have to say about that. I know that some schools in Maine have done Forest Fridays, and in Vermont, where they're outside all day and they're able to see birds and participate in this wonderful resource that we have here in Maine.
Sarah, I know this is something you really believe in.
Yeah, definitely. So one resource I would point everyone to who's looking for information on the topic of schools and outdoor learning is the Children and Nature Network. And they are sort of the clearinghouse for all the research that goes on about the benefits of kids spending time outside. So there are, when Richard Liu wrote his book back in 2006 about Last Child in the Woods, you know, that was just sort of the beginning of this study. And now there have been hundreds and hundreds of studies that demonstrate the social benefits, the emotional, the physical benefits for kids, the academic benefits, just general well-being, so many benefits of time spent outside. And what Laura was referencing is the fact that, you know, we can't right now, we can work to change the big systems, but we can't immediately move families from one community to another or change the communities instantly. But schools can be the great equalizer. They have that potential. If we guarantee that kids are getting outdoor time, we can bring those benefits to all kids in all communities. That's something that's happening right now. Schools are contemplating what they're going to do this fall. I know you just had quite a few calls last week on that topic. And using the outdoors where we know it's more airflow, it's just a healthier environment, that's something that they're figuring out. How can we do some of our teaching outdoors? I know we're in conversation locally with all the schools we work with about how we can support schools in getting their kids outdoors for more of the time this coming year as a way to battle the two other options, neither of which are great, virtual learning or indoor hybrid model. So
yeah,
there's challenges to all three, but the benefits for outdoor learning are huge and well-documented.
Laura, thanks so much for your call.
Can I jump in a little
I'm going to let both of you jump in. Bob, go ahead.
All right. I'll just add that, you know, the department has lots of resources for teachers to incorporate nature into their classroom. So we've a long time been involved in Project Wild, Project Learning Tree, Project Wet, and we've recently partnered with Purdue University on a program called The Nature of Teaching, offering resources and professional development for Maine educators to overcome some of those barriers of curriculum needs to get the kids outside and participate in those activities.
I have an email here from Philip. While the shutdown has increased interest and awareness of all sorts of natural phenomena, it has also put at serious risk many of the environmental education programs that play a role in our state's education system. As we begin to reopen schools, we have to keep these small, mostly small nonprofit organizations in mind. And then Greg writes, I work trails at Acadia National Park, and several weeks ago, before the park opened to the public, a barred owl visited our crew in the afternoon, a common winged critter. But what was special about this is the proximity of this individual, about 30 feet. We were graced with the owl's presence for about five-ish minutes. I've spent a lot of time in the North Woods, from New York to Maine, and often hear the bard's legendary call, but this is the first time I've seen it so close. And Nat, I'm going to add to that, I've seen a pileated woodpecker family much, much closer than I ever would have, and I think I actually saw the babies fledge. Do you think animals are feeling a little more, I don't know, courageous, a little more trusting of humans right now?
Well, maybe we're not just hustling and bustling around as much, and so we're not perceived as much as a threat. Could be. No, I don't know. That's a wonderful sighting, and what a spectacular, charismatic bird to see. Jennifer, can I just add something to
response
to Laura's question about equity? Because I think it's such a wonderful question on many levels. And one of the levels is racial justice, which has been on a lot of our minds this spring. And I just want to say that there's some fantastic things, initiatives to open up nature to people of color, blacks, indigenous, and English language learners. And you don't have to live out in the countryside. You can be right in Portland, and you're not far from trails parks. There's Black Birders Week and Black Botanist Week. And I just want to mention Maine Audubon has a wonderful celebration of black children's literature. So you can take your children to Gilson Farm in Falmouth, and go on a story walk to look at a children's book called Beautiful Blackbird by Maine author Ashley Bryan. So there are lots of wonderful ways, and I think land trusts and organizations like Maine Audubon are really starting to pay attention to the diversity and equity issue as well.
All right. Well, you didn't even know this, Nat. You gave us a wonderful segue. On the line with us now is Jared Fong, who is a recent Colby College grad who now works with the Southern Maine Conservation Collaborative and Teens to Trails. Jared, thanks for giving us a call. And follow up on what Nat is talking about. Tell us about the work you're doing with the Southern Maine Conservation Collaborative.
Hi. Yeah, it's great to be on. I do a lot of work with the Southern Maine Conservation Collaborative surrounding environmental equity. And that also incorporates racial equity because we think a lot about intersectionality. And one point I kind of would like to raise is that when we're talking about environmental equity and access, access isn't always just physical access. And that's because when we think about communities, for example, the large immigrant communities in Portland or in Lewiston, the outdoors and the environment aren't necessarily something to be enjoyed. Sometimes it's a harsh environment. It's a environment that they have to think of as like a dangerous environment that they step out into every time they leave their house. And so when we talk about equity, we really have to think about what does an aesthetic evaluation of a bird mean to someone who's never really seen a bird before, or someone who thinks of like a wolf or a deer as something to be afraid of. And I think like as Western society, we are really quick to assume that everyone is going to enjoy a bushy-tailed deer just because they're charismatic, because they have those big eyes and we can relate to them because they're animals. But what about people who have to rely on the environment for food and are doing gardening, and that's their way of connecting to the environment and that's their way of being outside? And so in my work with the Southern Maine Conservation Collaborative, we are really trying to diversify the ways that people expect to connect with the environment and in a way that kind of combats traditional perceptions of aesthetic evaluation. So just appreciating it because it's pretty. So really diversifying those life ways.
Tell us about the work you do with Teens to Trails. What does that organization do?
Yeah, Teens to Trails is a great organization. I just stepped on as a communications manager, and I've been put in charge of trying to diversify the way we communicate, just because a lot of times places can resort to, you know, just pretty pictures of landscapes, and oftentimes when you see that over and over again, it kind of gets like greenwashed. And so we're looking to diversify the way we communicate, in the way that we tell stories, in the way that people are like visualizing their relationship with nature, and really elevating the stories of people who aren't traditionally seen in the outdoors. For example, myself, I try to elevate the stories of Black and Indigenous people because their way of interacting with the outdoors can be very different and very unique to what traditional environmentalism expects.
All right. And because you're not busy enough, tell me about the Changemakers Network you're also a part of.
The Changemakers Network is a subsidiary of the Maine Environmental Education Association, and it's this really powerful network of a lot of youth and young adults all over the state who are doing advocacy work and policy work. We do a lot of resource sharing. I've been very grateful to connect with Olivia Grizzett, who's the head of the Changemakers Network, and they really get stuff done. Like, ever since I went to one of their gatherings, I realized how much capacity and how much power that youth voices have when it comes to addressing issues of equity.
Wonderful. Well, Jared, thanks for calling in. That's Jared Fong. He works with the Southern Maine Conservation Collaborative and Teens to Trails. We're going to take another quick break. If you want to talk about the nature you've been observing around you, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling. With help from AltE Store, providing solar power, battery backup equipment, and advice to solar installers and DIYers since 1999, AltE Store. Maine Media, offering photo, film, and writing workshops online in real time. Learn more at mainemedia.edu. And Libby and Sunupix, committed to providing a fun and safe family activity. New picking guidelines are posted at libbysunupix.com.
On the next Living on Earth, lessons learned from a wildlife rehabilitator.
I see the world through a bird's point of view, and I've come to that ability by being their mother, by raising them.
I'm Poppy Bascom, Saving Jemima, Life in Love with a Hard Luck Jay. That's next time on Living on Earth from PRX.
And that's coming up Sunday morning at 7 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today, we're learning about observing the natural world, thanks in part to the pandemic and less traffic and more time looking out our kitchen windows. My guests are Bob Cordes with the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, Sarah Rogers with the Cadence River Education Alliance, and Nat Wheelwright, Professor Emeritus at Bowdoin College. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Going to Francesca calling from Windham. Hi, Francesca. Go ahead.
Thank you so much for taking my call. So I am a biologist and outreach specialist with Maine Audubon's Coastal Birds Crew. And I actually just hopped off the beach looking at piping plovers, which is one of the bird species that we focus on in the state, as it's a state endangered bird and federally threatened. And something I always have found interesting this season is people will stop us on the beach and say, oh, we've heard the birds are doing fantastically this year, and it must be because there was no one on the beach for those first really crucial months where they're trying to find their nesting sites. And we don't want to attribute the fact that people weren't on the beach to their success. We really see that the success we're seeing with these birds, we have 98 pair in the state, and it goes up every year, is to the partnerships that we've developed with the federal and state wildlife agencies and municipalities, our incredible volunteer base, and other nonprofits and more. So I just wanted to kind of chime in with that note as well.
Francesca, thank you so much for calling in. But the bottom line is you're telling us that there's good news this year on the piping plover front.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So again, like I said, they're going up every year, and they're looking good. We see lots of birds fledging off our beaches now, and the season is certainly wrapping up. One thing that I think that in terms of the pandemic we have seen that's kind of funny is towards the beginning of the season, we did have some pairs that chose to nest in the middle of some major pathways, for example. So we had to close those down just for a couple weeks, but it really worked out well all around. We worked so well with the towns to kind of make sure these birds get off the beach and come back next year.
Well, Francesca, thank you so much for calling in. We have a couple questions here that have to do with hummingbirds, or one a comment and a question. An email from Bruce: we have become fascinated by hummingbird behavior, from the males doing the dance in front of females to the direct male competition. A little bit of nectar and a cheap feeder can yield a huge reward in entertainment. But then Earl writes, each year we wait for the hummingbirds to appear at our picture window, and then we put out the food. Same this year. But I found a dead hummingbird on the back deck. It looked like it had been attacked. Do they have natural predators? Nate? That?
Yes. Well, I fear that that may relate back to what Noah said about building strikes. When people find dead birds on their porch, often the culprit, I'm afraid to say, is a plate glass window. And what we do with our windows, which we had to learn the hard way when we first moved to this house, which has some big windows, and we discovered a few birds banging into them. When birds are migrating in particular, we just take that very inexpensive plastic bird netting that people put over fruit trees, fruit shrubs, and so on, and just drape it over the windows a foot away. That's one thing. You can put silhouettes of hawks and so on, but those apparently don't work very well. So if you're having problems discovering dead birds on your porch, I hope people would take some steps not to have their house contribute to the decline in bird numbers.
We did some of the tape this year with the advice of Doug Hitchcock's over at Audubon, and it seems to have worked, though it does change the look of the window. You can see it.
Yeah, there are different trade-offs. The tape works fabulous. I think you have to cover something. I don't know what it is. It's like on the order of 30% of your window to effectively have birds notice it so they don't mistake it for the reflection of a forest that they fly into. I've found that this light netting works better, because you get used to it, you look right through it, and it's fine. And then I find in the middle of the summer and after the birds have passed through in the spring and fall, I can take it down. If you're feeding birds close to your house and there's a feeder near your window, then you're going to have to keep your netting up, unless you want lots of bad karma of dead birds on your...
And it really is bad karma, isn't it? We'll go to Olivia, who's calling from East Wakefield. Hi, Olivia. Go ahead.
Hi. I am currently a field biologist with the Loon Preservation Committee, and I just wanted to speak on behalf of the issues that, waterfowl are facing, at least that I've seen on the lakes, because of such a high anthropogenic activity. I think during, COVID and everything, people are using this opportunity to get away to, beautiful Maine and New Hampshire and Vermont, and specifically the lakes, if they have the chance to. And such high anthropogenic activity on the lakes can definitely be detrimental to waterfowl. I've specifically noticed that a lot of my nests that I've been monitoring have just failed, because I know a lot of birds, especially loons, are very sensitive to that anthropogenic activity, and they will just, flush the nest if they're at all approached. So I've been noticing a lot of failures this year, just, I'm assuming, due to very high activity on the lakes.
Bob, thoughts?
Yeah, I think, definitely illegal to harass wildlife, and if anybody is out there noticing it, then give the Maine Warden Service a call to take a look at it.
All right. Thank you, Olivia, for your call. We're going to go to Unity and Chase. Hi, Chase. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a question regarding something that one of the panelists said earlier. It's very interesting that migratory birds may have a better chance of reaching their destination because lights in buildings have been turned off during the virus. And because I'm speaking from the point of view of a human being who can see better when lights are on, I'm curious about how a dark building would assist the birds rather than having them fly into it because they can't see it.
Sure. And Nat, we were talking about a theory that Noah had. What do you think? Do you think that there would be a reason that birds would be less likely to fly into a building that is not lit up?
Yeah. The problem with lit up buildings at night is that birds like moths are attracted to light, and it disorients them. And I'm not sure what the reasons might be. It could be that they use moonlight to migrate at night. But what happens is they mistake the buildings, I suppose, for the guidance of light, and they will crash into it. So if you turn a lot of buildings during the heat, during the peak of migration in major cities, actually people are cooperating by turning off the lights for, let's say, the custodians working at night to clean up the offices to protect migrating birds. So it's really a phenomenon similar to moths and other insects being attracted to lights.
Chase, thanks for your question. It's a good one. Kara on Facebook says, I wanted to encourage people to explore their local land trust properties and also become members. When the beaches and larger trail systems closed down around us during the quarantine, we loved exploring new land trust trails near our home. We've also enjoyed more time to garden and especially enjoy planting native flowers to encourage pollinators. And Bob, any follow-up on the network of land trusts around the state?
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of them have websites and a great trail network and very welcoming to activity. And I think they're, you know, one of the places free for public use that is great for people to go out and enjoy, similar to state parks and state public reserve lands or various wildlife management areas.
Sarah, you got a shout out on Facebook. This is from Corey. Corey writes, since we have not been able to hike with Sarah this summer, our favorite naturalist, we've been hiking with an app called Seek, S-E-E-K. It is great for identifying plants, insects, and mammals. Do you know about this app, Sarah?
I don't. Corey often teaches me about new apps, though.
Okay, we'll have to look it up. S-E-E-K. Go ahead, Nat.
Can I share a great app?
Sure.
Free, and it's also, you can just get on just online anywhere, plantnet.org. And all you have to do is take a picture of any plant whose name you don't know, and you drop it in a box, and it will tell you what it is. It's the most extraordinary app. Plantnet.org.
Thank you. We'll go to Pamela calling from Seal Cove. Hi, Pamela.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm an environmental educator in New York City. And in Maine in the summer. I work with a group called Christadora, and my friend gave me a wonderful idea today. She's hiking in the mountains out west, and she said, you know, I'm so grateful for all the running and the mountain biking that I get to do out there, but I really care about the Black Lives Matter issue, and I really care about social justice issues. So she is keeping track of her miles in the mountains every week and giving a donation to an organization that she then needs to learn more about what they're doing and read about them. And so she's paying it forward that way. I thought it
was
great.
All right. Well, Pam, thank you. What a lovely idea. We're going to move to Clarissa calling from Harpswell. Hi, Clarissa. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. I was in the Brunswick Charles Shopping Plaza around 7:30 the other day, and I saw what I'm guessing was a baby mink, unless it was somebody's pet ferret. And I don't know. I thought it was really cool. I've never seen one in the wild before, let alone in the parking lot.
That's wonderful, Nat. That's your neck of the woods. What do you think? Did she see a baby mink?
Yeah, could easily have been, and it could be an example of just a little less foot and car traffic and animals venturing into places where you don't ordinarily see them. What a cool sight.
Clarissa, thanks for calling and sharing that. I want to read here an email from Tim. Once you begin to make observing nature part of your daily routine, you learn to expect the unexpected. Sarah, I bet you couldn't agree more.
Yes, that is absolutely my guiding principle, whether I'm training teachers or talking with parents or leading summer camp. You absolutely never know what you're going to see. And sometimes that's how I get my kids out the door, actually. They say, well, what are we going to do? I'm like, I don't know. Let's see what we find. And, you know, there's never been a time when I've regretted going outside and been bored. So I think that's a great phrase he came up with.
Well, on that note, happy Friday, everybody. Thank you so much for being with us. My guests were Sarah Rogers, who is school program coordinator with the Cadence River Education Alliance, or CREA, Nat Wheelwright, professor emeritus at Bowdoin College and author of The Naturalist Notebook, and Bob Cordes, special projects coordinator of the Wildlife Division of the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. Links mentioned on the program will be on the Maine Calling webpage very soon. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Our theme music was composed by Mike Jandrow. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.